You are listening to The Edge, AM 1550, WURP, Braddock, Pittsburgh.
Good morning, Pittsburgh diners and travelers. Good afternoon to our overseas listeners, and good morning to Peter.
Good morning, good morning.
And welcome, Monsieur Chef François Payard, who is, in my mind, a genius pastry chef, and we're going to be talking to him. François, welcome.
Thank you so much. Good morning to you, too.
Bonjour, François.
Bonjour.
And you are, François, a third-generation French pastry chef.
Yes.
Born in Nice. And you are also a July baby, because I am, too. My birthday is a few days before yours.
Oh, yeah.
So give us just a little bit of your background. We're going to end up talking about your wonderful appetizer cocktail hors d'oeuvre book, Bite Size. But you were born in Nice, and how did you get here? What happened?
Well, tell you the truth is I'm a third-generation pastry chef, like you say, and I pretty much grew up in the pastry, you know, see my grandfather, see my father in the pastry shop. When I was younger, you know, everybody told me, oh, I should be working like maybe in the catering business because my brother was already a pastry chef, and I say, okay, let's try. And but I don't find a job, for the summer, and I find a job as a pastry chef. Alors, I was 13, and I start like a summer job, making a raspberry tart, making things. And I don't know, I start to like it. I say, no, I don't want to do catering. I want to do pastry. And I start to work with this gentleman, and I stay like in the pastry shop for like 5 years. And after that, I went to the army and I liked the pastry shop, but it was maybe missing something. And after that, I realized I work in the restaurant. And if you can see the pastry size, and you can see the craziness of the kitchen,
Oh, right.
Then in the pastry shop, you have just a production to it.
Right.
You don't have the craziness of the service.
And you like the excitement, the adrenaline, the craziness.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And I start to work in the restaurant, and I work in the many big restaurant in Paris. And after that, in Paris, I realized and I was the only one, at the time, was not speaking English. And I'm still a very bad accent. And I realized and I should do something. And one day, a customer, and he's always flying to New York and Paris, was telling me, oh, maybe it's an opportunity and know somebody, in New York, And I say, okay, why not? I try. And I realized and there was a great opportunity. And I come to New York and I start to like it. And I supposed to be for 18 months, a training visa. And now I'm here for the last 16 years,
We're not going to report you, though, François. I hope immigration is not listening. They're probably not working this morning anyway.
No, they don't work on the holidays.
Now, who did you start working for in New York?
I worked at Le Bernardin for like 2 years,
Who was chef there?
It was Gilbert Lecoz, and at the time was Ebrard Muller, and 2-3 months later, he just after that left. And Eric, the new chef, and he's a chef now.
And repair, yes.
Yeah, was with Eric, And together we opened like a Brasserie Lecoz in Miami, the one they opened in Miami.
Right.
And
right.
I stayed approximately like for 2.5 years. And after that, I come, and Daniel was coming to dinner sometime at Le Bernardin and asked me to be his pastry chef. And I opened Daniel with him, I stayed with Daniel for like 4.5 years. And I always tell Daniel that my dream was to have a pastry shop, but with a bistro, with a restaurant like that. And pretty much, Daniel's partner helped me to open Payard, and that was the idea to have a restaurant and a pastry shop. And I had this idea for very, very long time. Yeah. And it's an amazing idea, but, it's crazy at the same time because both have energy and both have a synergy to it. But someday, like during the holiday, when it's crazy, it's very difficult to manage because the shop is busy, the restaurant is busy.
Oh, why?
But the good thing is always attraction. One brings the other. You just come to the shop sometime and you realize, oh, it's a restaurant in the back. Let's try the restaurant.
Uh-huh.
Or maybe some people only heard about the restaurant and they say, oh, let's buy a box of chocolate on my way out.
Uh-huh.
It's really like a synergy to the place,
Right.
And that was always my dream. And every business starts, you know, you start small, a bistro and a pastry shop. And after that, we develop the catering business. The catering is, the name is Testing by Paya. And is my wife, Alexandra, she's the owner. And tell you the truth, the catering come a little bit after, you know. And for us, was an extension of the business.
Now, why? How did you meet Alexandra?
I met her. She was working at a pharmaceutical company.
Uh-huh.
And after, she come to work with me at Daniel.
Uh-huh.
She was at the hostess, you know, and knowing the client and everything, because the client is the same client that we have over here, because it was on 76, you know. And then she learned the size of the business. And tell you the truth, the catering come like 2-3 years after. And for us, it's pretty simple. No, it's not simple. Nothing is simple. But I would like to say it's much more easier, because having a pastry shop and having a kitchen, pretty much you pick a little bit from the pastry shop and you pick a little bit from the kitchen, and you can make a different menu. But, you know, it's easier to manage than if you start from scratch, let's say. And
you build on what you already are known for.
Exactly. Right. And what we have two chefs working full-time on the catering. And after that, you know, we like 2-3 weeks ago, this last week was quiet. We have only like 5 parties a week. You know, this week is only like 3 parties. January is the slowest time for us. But during the Christmas time, we do like up to 18 parties a week.
That's a lot, yeah.
It's not really a lot, but we like to stay small, and we like to stay exclusive. And tell you the truth, that's the idea, you know. Then after all the party we're doing and everything, I become to say, oh, why not put a book together of all the canapé, because we get so many compliments of the canapé. And that was the idea, to create this book by size. And I really love the idea to have everything in small bite.
I do too. I love it.
You know, for some people, I have a very good review on the book. You know, the book is very affordable, $19.95, 68 pictures. I just have
photos are just gorgeous.
Yeah, I was taking all the pictures of my best friend photographer, and we play with the picture to make them very real and to make sure that they're very close up, that these people can do it. I just think that sometimes, you know, when you play it, you know, the problem with people when they buy the book, they think it's too complicated, but everything is a little complicated in life. Nothing is easy than you have to take from the freezer and you can cook. But I think the book, you know, is for every level. You have few canapés and they're very simple to make. Few a little bit more difficult, and few of them, they're a little bit more exciting. You have to choose the one you feel like they are to your level. I think the book is a great great way to make many recipe. But I just think that sometime I heard a customer was telling me, oh, I bought the book, you know, and to hello 16 tomato, it takes how long? I just say you cut you slice a baby tomato and you just take a Parisian scoop and that's it. That takes a long time. You know, people always, because people have a different understanding about canapés or little bite size. You know, it takes a little time, but you know what? I think, you know, if you really love to entertain, I think you may really love the book. Some recipes, like I said before, are a little bit complicated, but choose the one that they may fit to your level.
Which one are you talking is complicated?
No, I don't say complicated. I say complicated because they are 4 steps. You know, like the eggplant tart is one of my favorites.
Oh, right.
It's a puff pastry that I say you can buy to the supermarket.
Yes.
You have to bake the puff pastry. After, you have to cook a tomato concassé. It's like a tomato sauce, if you want. You know, that takes 20 minutes to cook, but you have nothing to do. It's cooking on its own.
Yeah.
After, you have to sauté the eggplant. You know, Japanese eggplant takes a few minutes. And you just have to prepare, you know, the goat cheese. But people are looking at the picture, they say, 4 steps for this little thing. But this little thing is like making an appetizer. It's just we shrink to 1 bite. That's the whole idea, to get an excitement when you eat this canapé, you know.
Now, Francois, would it be a clue to readers who have the book that the number of steps sort of equates to the complexity? So if something's got 4 steps, then it's going to be easier than something that's got 8 steps?
Sure, because you know what? It's always easier. Less step it is, faster it is to make. But, you know, you don't really always, and you know that, you can always get the same result with a things in two steps and the same things in six steps. If the complexity is not the same. That's the reason during the whole book I try to manage things very simple, like the you have in the book the potato chips, you know, with the salmon. You know, this one is only two steps, very easy to make. But you know what? You know, I just have a comment and somebody tell me, oh, why do you have to put the salmon in the freezer? You know, I have to wait for an hour to freeze salmon. I say yes, because that's the best way when the salmon is a little bit cut to get a beautiful and a thin slice. Now, if you don't want to wait, you can do the night before.
Right. You know, you have tips on doing things in advance in this book.
It's all the tips inside the book. But I would like to say that I think the book is not complicated. I think the book is pretty simple. But good things, I want to say, take always time.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, I'm looking at paella cakes with chorizo.
This one is a little bit more...
Looks a little bit complicated.
Yes, no, and I agree with you. But you see... When you have a bite of this one, you have all the sensation and having a bowl of paella in front of you. And that, like I say, is a little bit more step, but you know what? I think it's like you, when you have a reader or you have people they love your show and everything, you have to have for everyone. You know, so, and for a book too, we have some recipe simple, some recipe a little bit more elaborate, and few of them interesting if somebody loves to cook.
Now, say you just decided to have a cocktail party. What do you think is like the ideal number for a cocktail party?
There's a truth. My ideal number is when I do cocktail party and when we plan cocktail party, an hour of cocktail is 10 canapés.
Okay.
10 to 15 canapés. Depend what you're doing the party. If it's Upper East Side, we count 15 canapés, 12 to 15 for the canapé. And if it's for... party than we do sometimes for the French consulate. We know they eat a lot. We put it a bit more. But you see, when you entertain, you know, sometimes in the apartment, people doesn't eat so much because they're talking and they don't want to look like they eat too much, you know. You know, you have to know that the rule of thumb is an hour is 15 canapés. And what is 15 bites? Maybe a lady may have only 10 and a guy maybe have like 16 or 17. You're talking about everything is one bite. It's not too much.
Let me clear that up, Francois. What you're talking about, the 15 is 15 pieces.
Yes.
Times the number of people who are going to attend is the number you'll need altogether.
Exactly. Whatever, if you select only one canapé, if it's 10 people, I will make sure that I have 15 of the one canapé. That's it. And I think, you know, for an hour of cocktail, 15 canapé is not too much.
Depends
how big as you want to make them, you know.
Could you... hold on and stand by for us while we take a break for some advertisement?
Yes.
And I'll talk to you in the other line. We'll take a break.
T1 Internet access wasn't affordable to many companies as little as 2 years ago. Service providers were charging in the thousands of dollars, keeping the benefits of a T1 connection out of most companies' reach. ASP Station is now offering the faster and more reliable T1 service at a price significantly less than 2 years ago. The speed of a T1 for both sending and receiving data is simply amazing and will change the way your business runs indefinitely. You'll wonder how you ever lived without it. Call ASP Station now for details. 412-661-6001. 412-661-6001. Log on aspstation.net for more information. ASP Station, it's the way to go fast.
Call ASP Station now for details. 412-661-6001. That's 412-661-6001. Log on aspstation.net for more information. ASP Station, it's the way to go. Fast.
Influenza is a serious disease.
Are you talking to me?
If you have asthma, diabetes, or other chronic medical conditions, yes.
Are you talking to me?
If you're 50 or older, yes. If your child is between 6 and 23 months, yes.
Are you talking to me?
If you live or work with those at high risk, yes. Influenza will kill as many as 36,000 people this year. It's that serious. Prevent influenza. Get immunized. A message from the National Foundation for Infectious Diseases.
Welcome back. You're listening to Ann and Peter Haig on the menu. Don't forget www.onthemenuradio.com to catch up with all the buzz of what we're doing. We have on one line, we've been talking to pastry chef and chef in general extraordinaire, Francois Payard. And we're going to talk to him a little bit and connect him up with our guest that just joined us, who is Natalie McLean, who is so many awards-winning wine and drink writer, including one as the world's best drink writer in the World Food Media Awards in Australia. But we'll get back to that. Natalie, welcome.
Thanks, Anne.
Join us with talking a little bit about Francois. What kind of things are you looking for when you're selecting the libations for your cocktail party?
Tell you the truth, you know, when we plan a party, first you have to know what kind of canapé you want to plan. You know, it's always three kind of canapé. You have fish, you have the meat, and you have the vegetarian. If I plan a party, and I'm always planning like maybe eight canapés, but depend, you know, that I'm talking about to entertain with the chef. If you want to do your own party, maybe you can plan only on three or four canapés. If I plan like six to eight canapés, I always like to make different things, like one or two vegetarian, one or two with the meat, or one with the poultry, and after some fish inside. Because you know that somebody may have allergy, you know that somebody may don't like something. By having eight different canapés, when they pass around, you realize and you may fulfill everybody's needs, and you may make everybody pretty much happy.
Now, listeners, let's just catch up. Let's just make sure we're on track with Francois now. We're talking about eight different kinds.
Yes.
Rather than in the previous segment, we're talking about the number of pieces to calculate in total.
Yes.
Okay, very good.
And so then what, Natalie, would you do with the drinks for this party?
Well, whenever I'm recommending wines for a large gathering where there's going to be many different flavors for the nibbles or even for a dinner party, I recommend a red and a white that are what I call switch-hitter wines. So they appeal to a large number of palates and go with a lot of different flavors. And they would be, for a white wine, I would recommend just a slightly off-dry, just a touch of sweetness in a German Riesling or one from Washington. And then in the reds, I would go with a New World Pinot Noir, like one from California or Oregon. They're delicious wines, they're very food-friendly, and as I say, they appeal to many people.
Now, what about sparklers?
Oh, sparkling wine is a terrific suggestion, actually, because that is actually a fallback wine for me when it comes to tough food and wine matches. So foods and flavors that defeat other wines, anything with egg in it, spicy hot, those kinds of flavors, a bubbly will really go down nicely. And I actually like New World bubblies, like California bubblies, as opposed to French champagne, especially if you are serving a larger crowd, you're also going to save some money that way.
And Francois, you know, what do you think about that, Francois? We took a swipe at France there. But you can respond.
I'm really listening to the suggestion. No, tell you the truth, it's true that, you know, it depends. If you entertain and you have a small budget, you know, a sparkling champagne is perfect. You know, I think few people may know the difference, depending if they entertain a lot or not. You know, tell you the truth, more and more, we have a request to having only white wine and no more red. Just is the purpose of people getting scared and having their house, you know, and having a glass of red wine going wrong, you know.
Oh, no.
Oh, okay.
You know, that's pretty much in New York, you know, but pretty much, you know, when you entertain with friends, you don't really mind that you like to share your place with your friend and everything. But more and more, we have people asking us only for champagne and white wine only for the canapé.
You know, we did a party where we just had a Prosecco, I think it was, and one of our favorite friends came into the kitchen and said, "Do you have anything else? Champagne gives me a headache. I drink Manhattans."
so we produced
a Manhattan doesn't give you a headache.
so we produced a Manhattan. What can you do?
Yeah, Francois, listen to. Do you know Natalie's background? It's kind of impressive.
Yeah, I was listening.
Natalie, give us just a. First of all, we did name your book, Red and White Drunk All Over, and read the subtitle, Rabbit.
A Wine-Soaked Journey from Grape to Glass.
Jump back to your first exposure to wine and just give us a quick run through of how you got to where you are. I guess it was that when you graduated college and you had the Brunello.
Yes, that's right. I do remember that evening. I was with my husband-to-be, Andrew, so I guess the wine helped all that work out as well. But I remember it was my first really good wine. Up till then, I had been drinking rather cheap stuff. I remember my Scottish family, it was beer and whiskey, and when wine was served twice a year, Christmas and Easter, usually from the same box. So this was quite a step up, having this Brunello at this Italian restaurant. And I remember just bringing the glass up toward my mouth, and I stopped because all of the aromas kind of rushed out to meet me, and I thought, what is this? I didn't know how to describe it, but I knew how it made me feel and the beautiful aromas, and I knew I wanted to learn more about it.
Right, and so you proceeded to do exactly that.
Exactly, yeah. Yes.
Now you were,
it was very motivational.
you jumped in France, too, didn't you?
Well, yes, that's where I started the book, in Burgundy, because I'm just a Pinot Noir lover, and so I wanted to go where many wine lovers consider benchmark Pinot Noir is made, in Burgundy, and then from there be able to compare that wine to New World regions like California, which is where I traveled after France.
Huh. Well, that's, do you have any particular favorites in the wine field, Francois?
No, I love Pinot Noir. I love every wine. Tell you the truth, no, because I'm French, you know. I make the wine list at Paya with my manager. Tell you the truth, we even have an award for the Wine Spectator. But the things, a wine list is pretty much for me like a menu, you know. And we have to cater to our clients. For me, in the wine list, you may look at my wine list. It's too many Pinot Noir, but it's what my people, my clients love, and the manager. On top of it is a Pinot Noir lover. Alors, it's what he's selling. You see, when you have a manager on the floor selling, he sells what he likes. And he's a lot of Bordeaux because it's a French restaurant. There is a true at home, too. I have a lot of Brunello, you know. I have things in my wine cellar. A lot of good stuff. But wine is like, more you taste them, more you know them. And it's true that they all have different complexity, but you have to see which one fits your palate the most, you know. I like to try every one of them, but to the end of the day, I really know what I want to drink every night.
Yes.
Well, Francois, before we go, let's make sure the listeners know how to find your pastry shop and your restaurant.
Yeah, but it's located on 1032 Lexington Avenue, New York, New York, 10021. And if you want to look on the website, it's www.paya.com.
And the cross street on Lexington is?
73 and 74.
Very good.
Well, Francois, I'm delighted we finally connected here, and everybody should try this book. I'm going to start making some of these. It was a debate for a while if I was going to attempt any kind of pastry.
Maybe we should go to Pie Out and find out what they really taste like.
I think that's what we'll do.
Well, thank you so much.
Thank you, Francois.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Natalie.
Yes.
I'm trying to find my favorite story in your book.
He keeps telling me this story.
But perhaps it's not in your book, but it sticks in my mind that you or someone else was sitting with someone who he put out little spit glasses, but you noticed after you tasted all the wines that he hadn't spit anything. He explained something. Now, was that you or is that somebody else's book?
I think that might be somebody else's.
It must be somebody else's book. Okay.
In my book.
He had something really wonderful.
Leslie Sprocco.
Leslie Sprocco. You must know Leslie's work, I guess.
Do you know Leslie?
Yes.
I can't remember what he said, but he said something about his spit cup.
You're really straightforward and honest with us, Natalie.
Okay, well, anyway, we know who.
Natalie, tell us how you structured this book.
Well, I tried to find the most obsessive, passionate, colorful people I could in the wine industry, and that wasn't difficult, actually. And by telling their story, tell the story of wine. And so I started out, as I mentioned, in Burgundy, but I also wanted to start with the beginning of wine, where it's grown, benchmark, all that kind of stuff. But I sought out one of the most passionate Burgundian winemakers, and that is Aubert de Villaine at Domaine Romani Conti.
Oh, yeah.
And he's a wonderful man to talk to, and he really has almost a spiritual sense in growing and making wine. And we had a wonderful day together, he took me down into his cobweb cellars, and we were tasting wine, and he actually made me guess one of the vintages and said he would lock me in the cellar if I didn't get it right.
How much fun.
But you did get it right.
I did. It was total luck. I at that point, before I started guessing, I said, okay, you can lock me in here, but leave me with a corkscrew, please.
There you go. And this wine that you sampled, which was a 56 Romani Conti, retails for how much a bottle?
Oh, I don't know if you can even buy it on the market. I know their new vintages go for about $500 a pop, so that's probably a couple $1,000s. I don't know if he was having to do sort of a tax loss thing. I have no idea why he opened it, other than he's a very kind man.
Now, you mentioned the, what's his name, from Bonnie Doon?
Oh, yes, Randall Graham.
Randall Graham.
Yes.
I have been dying to get him. He is a character, and I have been dying to get him on the program, and nobody ever responds to email, so I'm going to have a call. But I heard that I didn't call because I heard that he was sick. Is he?
Well, you know, I visited him a couple of years ago, and again, I was looking for a passionate person, but in the new world, and this time I asked if I could help work the harvest, so that, you know, I started with the beginning of the life cycle of wine, and then go right to the end of it with harvest, and it was a wonderful experience. I mean, he is a provocative, interesting, creative man who asks great questions and is a soundbite a minute, but I was also able to get that full experience of being at a winery and in the vineyards at harvest, you know, when the hot September sun is beating down on your neck, and, you know, you feel basically like a human grape, completely crushed and sticky by the time you're done.
But you went through the entire business, too, so you were a sommelier for a day, you worked in a wine shop for a day.
That's right.
You described those experiences just wonderfully, and I think it seems to me that you got an immense new respect for the people who did this. It seems sort of easy to open a bottle of wine, and it seems easy to sell a bottle of wine, but you demonstrate just how skillful people need to be in order to be successful.
Absolutely. You know, doing those jobs, it's the difference between being in the driver's seat and being a passenger. It's so relaxing being a passenger, which is what we are when we're diners in a restaurant, and so we should be, or shopping for wine and getting help in a wine store. But when you're in the driver's seat trying to do those jobs, you realize just how much knowledge you have to have at your fingertips. Because as a wine writer, you know, if someone asks me a question via email or calls me up, I can usually go to a book sitting here in my office. But when you're on the restaurant floor and someone asks you a question, there's no, oh, wait a minute while I turn to my Oxford Companion for a moment. So it's a different kind of knowledge. And then there's all the interpersonal skills that go along with interacting with various wine lovers who have different levels of knowledge.
Now, we'll use this as a point to take a break. Will you stay with us for a while?
Oh, absolutely.
Great. We'll take a break.
Furnace working okay? How's your heating bills? You know, no kidding, an old or inefficient furnace can really add to the cost of keeping your home warm. If you want to keep costs down, get your furnace looked at, and I recommend Bolster DeHart Heating and Air Conditioning for that. The technicians at Bolster DeHart have been performing routine maintenance and installing high-efficiency heating and air conditioning systems in Pittsburgh since 1977. They're EPA-certified professionals who are continually factory-trained in all the latest installation and service techniques. They offer free estimates and don't even charge extra for Saturday service. They're a quality dealer you can trust. Stay warm this winter at the lowest possible cost. Call Bolster DeHart Heating and Air Conditioning at 412-367-3900. Maintenance or installation, Bolster DeHart Heating and Air Conditioning, 412-367-3900.
Mommy, for my birthday, I want a princess party.
Give your little girl a party she'll remember forever from Sweet Pea Parties.
Mommy, this is wonderful.
Sweet Pea Parties will send out beautiful handmade invitations and then bring decorations, princess gowns to dress up in, fabulous favorite bags, real linen and china, fun games, even a real princess to transform your home into your child's fantasy wonderland.
Do they do parties for boys too?
You bet they do. Safari adventures, pirates and dinosaur themes for the boys, princess, diva, and spa parties for the girls.
Yay!
Our hostesses make your party effort-free. They'll even send out thank you notes featuring each child's personal photo from the party. See for yourself at www.sweet-p-parties.com or call them 412 412-805-9623. Sweet Pea Parties, 412-805-9623.
Mommy, this was the best party ever.
Hi, everyone. This is Tom Rita, the networking guy and host of Pittsburgh's most unique business show, Business in the Fast Lane. We're on every Saturday morning from 12 noon to 1 p.m. right here on The Edge, 1550 a.m. For the past 24 months, we've been bringing the best and the brightest into our studios to offer you ideas, advice, and real-world examples to help you grow your business. So save those honeydews for the afternoon and join me, Tom Rita, every Saturday morning from 12 to 1 on The Edge for Business in the Fast Lane, Pittsburgh's best kept secret.
You are listening to The Edge, AM 1550, WURP, Braddock, Pittsburgh.
Welcome back. You're listening to On the Menu. Email us at any time, onthemenu@onthemenuradio.com. Visit our website, which is onthemenuradio.com.
And we really have a starstruck program today.
We do indeed. We have been interviewing, first segment we had Francois Bayard in his book, Bite Size. Then we moved on to Natalie McLean, who has a fascinating wine book out called Red, White, and Drunk All Over. And now we've picked up one of my favorite chefs, Charlie Palmer, who has a new book out called The Practical Guide to the New American Kitchen, which is, well, Charlie, I mean, how did you think of this? I don't know if you know about this, Natalie. This book is on special paper that doesn't it's stain resistant, water repellent.
Brilliant idea.
It's like incredible. It feels interesting.
First ever waterproof cookbook. So, which, you know, which came about after,
like,
you know, a long search and, you know, kind of, you know, I'm the kind of person that when someone says, oh, no, you can't do that, you know, that, you know, there's just no way to do that, that eventually we're going to figure out a way to do anything. So this is the culmination of a lot of thought and research and finally finding the right partner. And
is this Melcher?
Yeah, Melcher Media.
Well, you know, I've been after them because I'm doing a piece on foodie Valentine gifts, and they were the leaders in these adult pop-up books. Mm-hmm. So I was hoping they would have some gourmet pop-up book, but they don't.
They have
a sex manual and something. I forgot.
Well, there you go. That's good for Valentine's Day.
Some celebrity thing.
The aqua erotica book. There you go.
Yeah, anyhow. All right. So Natalie says that she's written piece about your wine angels.
So let's talk about the wine angels before we forget.
Sure.
How about, let's get some background on Charlie. Charlie, you are like a chef as well as, you know, diner chef. Every time we interview somebody and we say, who's your hero? They say Charlie Palmer.
Now, how could this be, Charlie? Tell us about that.
I mean, I don't know. You know, they're making me sound older than I actually am, I think.
What about the guy in Charleston? What's his name?
Bob Carter. Do you remember Bob Carter?
Oh, yeah, Bob. Yeah, sure.
You're one of his heroes.
Sure.
And I guess we have a chef in town, sort of, named Greg Allison.
Well, sort of.
Who was
one of my boys, yeah.
Greg was there? Okay, great.
Yeah,
Greg
was there for a while.
And, I mean, it just goes on and on and on. You seem to have a huge fan base.
No, that's one thing I really pride myself on is, you know, over the years, you know, we've had so many great people that, you know, have worked with me and with us as a company. And, I tell people, you know, they always ask me, what's your greatest, you know, achievement? I think it's, for me, it's like, you know, seeing young people, you know, that work with us and, you know, whether they stay with us or go out on their own or do different things, that they go on to do great things and become great chefs and, you know, restaurant people, them, you know, in their own right as far as a career, you know, so.
But
I get great satisfaction out of that.
Great. Well, where does the Charlie Palmer story start?
Well, I began cooking when I was, actually working in a kitchen when I was 14.
But you grew up on a farm. Let's get that in there right away.
Yeah, I grew up on a farm in upstate New York and, you know, working in a restaurant kitchen, actually dishwashing, pot washing in the beginning, you know, sure beat milking cows. So, you know, and then it kind of went on from there. I was very fortunate I got a job at the Colgate Inn, which is owned by Colgate University. And at the time there was a Swiss chef there that, you know, I don't know what he was doing in Hamilton, New York, but, you know, he kind of took me under his wing and I became the brunch chef because, you know, that's the last shift that anybody wants to work, you know, is brunch. And,
why
you know,
is
and then
that?
From there, I just got interested in my,
Why do you say that about brunch? I mean,
brunch is usually boring. Early morning, and you know, brunch is the toughest thing because you know everybody coming to brunch or dining at brunch is either they're hungover from the night before, or they're there for a family reason that maybe don't want to be there.
Or it's Mother's Day.
Breakfast in general, I think, is tough because everybody has kind of a particular idea about what they eat for breakfast, you know?
Right.
Brunch shift is, you know, River Cafe days, you know, when I was a chef there, it was always, the brunch shift was always the toughest shift also. So
you went from there to where?
Well, I became the chef at the River Cafe early on. I was 23 when I was the chef there, and then.
So you were a wunderkind.
Well, I never looked at it that way, but I guess if you look back, I was pretty young. I never felt that way to me. I felt like I was ready, and you know, it was a challenge. But
well, we found out Natalie started as soon as she graduated from college. So
see, there you
but
go.
We're not going to ask her when that was.
No, otherwise you might ask us and we won't answer.
I don't answer questions.
So, when was the big breakthrough when Charlie started his own place?
Well, I opened my first restaurant when I was 28, Oriole, New York.
Oh, that was the first restaurant,
right.
Oriole.
Yeah, the first restaurant.
And you were only 28 when you did that.
28, yeah.
It's like an icon.
Having our 19th birthday this year. It's like we're almost 20 years old in New York.
Oh, wow.
It seems amazing to me because, you know, it's time flies by in this business so quickly. And, you know, like I said, you know, I'm just at the ripe age of 47, you know. People start looking at me like, wow, he's an icon. I'm like, I'm only 47. I'm not, you know.
But you now have quite an empire, though.
Yeah, we have a lot of restaurants, you know, and we're doing a lot of interesting things. And, you know, I think we're, as a company, we're at the right size. You know, we do projects that I feel really fit, you know, our company and as a group, you know, and we have just an immense amount of talent, you know, chef-wise and everything else in the company.
Now, what? Two things. One, defining progressive American cuisine. And number two, everybody comments on your business skills. We recently interviewed Danny Meyer, and so I know how important that is. But you seem to have a natural knack for business. Let's start with progressive American.
Yeah, well, I mean, progressive American cooking, I've always felt, you know, as an American, you know, it's probably as a big American as there is. You know, I only drive Chevy, you know, automobiles. I really think that, you know, we live in the greatest place in the world. And, you know, I've cooked in other parts of the world. You know, I've spent quite a bit of time in France and in Belgium and some in Italy. And, you know, they're great places to be and huge for inspiration. But I think, you know, we truly do have the best of everything here in this country. And, you know, and I think we've seen that change over the last, say, 10 or 15 years, that, you know, as far as ingredients and, you know, and the level of restaurants, too. I truly believe that New York City at this point is the most important restaurant city in the world.
Everyone says that, yeah.
I mean, I probably wouldn't have said that 10 years ago.
You know who told us that, Charlie? Jacques Pepin told us that,
Jacques
too.
Pepin, yeah.
He admitted it. He said, it's hard for me to say this, but he said it's absolutely true that New York is the best restaurant city in the world right now.
So where did you go next? You went to Las Vegas next?
Yeah, I went to Las Vegas when I like to think that I was really a pioneer, and that was one of the most exciting things about it, you know, that at that time, to think in your mind that you could kind of be on the forefront of a whole food movement, you know, and this is something you couldn't do in other cities, I mean, because there already were great restaurants in San Francisco and Chicago and L.A. and everywhere else, you know, but Las Vegas, here was a chance to really be a pioneer in some ways in bringing great food to what I saw at the time, and it's exactly what's happened. Is it's just an incredibly fast growing city.
I mean, it's worked where Time Warner is not working, is it?
Time Warner in New York?
You mean Warner Center?
I don't know. I mean,
Warner Center.
You know.
I mean, that's been, they're going to be like a revolving door, those restaurants.
Well, now, this is a good time to go back to Natalie. And Natalie, give us a journalist's report on Wine Angels, and then we can have Charlie respond.
I was kind of totally appalled, to tell you the truth, Charlie.
So go ahead, Natalie.
That was in the days when I was very active in women chefs and restaurateurs, and it didn't seem to fit into my my thought process at the time.
Oh, yeah, the Wine Angels?
Yeah, the Wine Angels.
Okay, so Natalie, tell us about a Wine Angel.
Well, you know, I was intrigued with the setup because my background is high tech. I used to work for a California-based computer company. So when I went to the restaurant in Los Angeles, I was fascinated not just with the wine angels, but the technology behind the wine tower and the tablets and choosing from the restaurant wine list, which was electronic. I thought it was brilliant.
Okay.
The wine angels were a nice diversion for my husband, but I was really focused on the tablets. And there was a wonderful sommelier there, whom I think has moved on since, but he was very helpful. And I just found it fascinating because if you're a wine nut, you love to dig deeper into the information. And these tablets had so much information, the wine notes, and you could keep going down, down, down into the to the information if you wanted to. And I guess that could be a problem because dinner could get cold in the meantime, but I loved it.
Yeah, but what about the flying thing? Come on, Natalie, tell us about the flying thing.
The flying thing, okay, well, it was very Mission Impossible. These women were in black cat suits, very attractive women, of course. I don't think anyone is old in Las Vegas, or at least we don't see them. Mm-hmm. And they were all on a very safe pulley system that went up along this tower. And how tall is the tower, Charlie?
It's 43 feet high.
Oh, wow.
It's basically
okay,
four
so they were going up,
tall.
Scaling
tall
up and down
house.
This tower to get the wines that you would order with your meal. So that was very entertaining. And to me, it was part of the entertainment experience
oh,
of
yeah.
the meal. I loved it.
What gave you the idea, Charlie? Somebody thought
well,
of it?
You know, the whole idea of the wine tower from the beginning was my partner in this restaurant is the hotel, basically. And Bill Richardson, who was, you know, my main guy at the time, you know, they owned this incredible amount and collection of wine. And the idea was like my idea was to take a different view of wine and get it out there where people can look at it, you know, because, you know, I think at that point, and I think still, you know, people, there's this mystique about wine that, you know, people tend to be a little uncomfortable about, like, you know, this kind of secretive, not knowing or being that knowledgeable about wine and being afraid to, like, really get out there and talk to sommeliers and
yeah,
you know,
but Natalie's
what they want.
Book is geared to getting rid of that, actually.
Yeah, but also the wine tower, because, you know, it puts it right out there in front of you. You know, and it's fun, and it's exciting. And I really venture to say that a lot of people that come into that restaurant will order, they may have never ordered a bottle of wine in their life. And they could, you know, they can feel free and comfortable, and it's right there in front of them. You know, and it makes it fun and exciting as opposed to, like, mysterious and dark cellar and, like, you know, not knowing the right wine to order and all that stuff. And this makes it fun. And, you know, I think in a lot of ways, you know, everybody says, well, it was a marketing tool. Well, of course it was, you know, but it was a marketing tool in the sense that, you know, it brings it out there, really makes it interesting and fun. And a lot of people, like in the wine world at the time, said, well, you know, Charlie, you know, it's a mockery. You know, he's doing something ridiculous. I'm telling you, this is the most important, in my mind, the most important step in wine marketing and accessibility that's happened in the last 15 years. I mean, it really is, because, you know, people love it. People attract, you know, people talk about it. It makes wine accessible to people, you know, and, you know, and it promotes, you know, a really fun aspect of wine that sometimes is not so much there, you know?
Yeah, now Natalie thinks that there's an aspect that we need to know about fun in wine too, right,
yeah.
Natalie?
I'm just wondering, Charlie, has anybody ever said, I want the one that's on the very top?
Yeah, of course.
I don't care how much it costs. I don't care what it is. I want the one that's at the top.
Well, in reality, though, those really expensive bottles aren't even in that tower. I mean, this is, you know, the tower is just part of, it's about a third of the wine inventory. And we have
could
two
you
other
hold
sellers,
this thought, know? Charlie and Natalie, and we're going to take a station break and then come back, okay?
Okay.
Sure, absolutely.
Okay, take a break.
Hi, friends. I'm Phil Marcus, the host of Real Estate 101, heard every Saturday here on The Edge, AM 1550. If you've been thinking about selling your house or buying a house, I'd like to speak with you. Choosing the right agent is one of the first and most important steps in the process of buying or selling real estate. It's critical that you choose an agent who has the knowledge and experience to not only find that perfect new home for you, but to also be able to guide you step by step through the often complicated real estate process. If you don't already have a realtor, may I offer my services? I've I've been a real estate agent in Pittsburgh for almost 30 years. I'm a life member of the Realtors Association, and I'm proud to say that I've earned both the GRI and the coveted CRS professional designations. Won't you call me at RE/MAX Heritage? The phone number is 412-241-4200, extension 154, or my email address is phil@philmarcus.com. That's 412-241-4200, extension 154, or phil@philmarcus.com. Let's talk.
The internet is crucial to your business. Everybody knows this, but did you know Nidhogg is the company you should call for internet service? Nidhogg, personal web page hosting for less. Business web page hosting, Nidhogg offers both Unix and NT server support. Nidhogg is the company you should call for dedicated internet access. Nidhogg offers DSL for high speed, low cost, always on access. DSL is great. It means no more dial up. Oh, by the way, do you remember that thing called the telephone? Do you remember when people used phone lines to access the internet? Oh, I'm sorry, you still use dial-up? Well, Nidhogg does that too. Local access telephone numbers? Okay, I don't understand it all either, but I do know that I need it, and I know where to get it. Nidhogg, Nidhogg.com, 412-661-5917. That's 661-5917, or log on, Nidhogg.com. Internet the Nidhogg way.
Have you been jazzing around yet? It's Sundays from 10 to 12 here on 1550. Get a taste of the latest jazz albums, a concert and club calendar, birthdays, awards, obituaries, and more. Plus featured artist interviews. That's a lot of jazzing. Check it out for yourself. Sponsored in part by Martini's Route 885 Jefferson, Original Recipe Italian Cooking, and Spider Rondinelli's Pittsburgh Jazz Giants, Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday. Jazzing around. Sundays 10 to 12 here on 1550 The Edge.
Welcome back to On the Menu. Currently, we've got Natalie McLean, who's a wine writer, award-winning wine writer, who has a new book out. And we have Charlie Palmer, who is, we're allowed to say, an icon, a chef icon, and a restaurateur icon as well. And we're going to be talking about his practical guide to the new American kitchen in a minute. But we wanted to first get you to Healdsburg, and then jump back a little bit to talk about, with all this inventory that you have in your wine tower, Natalie's going to tell us how she advises people to approach selection.
All right, sounds good. Well, I got the Healdsburg because I love Healdsburg. I mean, that was a
that's a coup.
You know, after being in New York for 25 years, you know, and still being in New York, I mean, that's one thing that people say, well, you know, you've moved to Healdsburg, but I split my time between the East Coast and West Coast.
Okay.
You know, and I tell people, you know, I truly have the best of all worlds because...
It's gorgeous. I love Healdsburg. Plug your restaurant
wonderful there
where we actually were fortunate enough to have lunch.
Yeah, Dry Creek Kitchen. It
was wonderful.
You know, it's just a great little town. You know, it's smack dab in the middle of the wine, you know, the wine world here. All my good friends and, you know, parents of the kids that go to school with are all winemakers or in the wine business in some way, it seems like, but which is a lot of fun for me, you know, and that's part of the reason why we're here is because it's such a great place for, you know, food and wine and, you know, growing and you know, it's just a beautiful part of the world.
Natalie, where do you live now?
I'm in Ottawa, Ontario, Canada.
Oh, you are in Ottawa. Then it's in Ottawa where Jillian served you something. It is Ottawa now that I remember. Okay. Have you ever wanted to live in wine country?
Oh, absolutely. Just for the warmth alone.
Oh, yeah.
We're colder on average than Moscow up here, but it's good for the work ethic. So, I've been to wine country, Napa, many times in my travels, both for the book and for other types of writing that I've done.
Well, let's do this wine selection dilemma. You want to kick it off, Natalie? What's your advice to the
sure.
buyer?
Absolutely. Well, I get a lot of questions on this. I through my website and my e-newsletter. A lot of people ask me about how do I choose from a restaurant wine list when I don't want to look cheap, when I don't want to declare out loud, for example, how much I want to pay for love or whatever, or the business deal. And a lot of people are wary of choosing the cheapest wine on the list. And, of course, they, you know, a lot of people don't have the budget for the most expensive, and so they often don't know where to turn because they're kind of fixated on price. And the first piece of advice that I give is if you're in the kind of restaurant that might have someone who is knowledgeable about wine, don't be afraid to ask. So even if that person isn't an official sommelier, it could be the person who put together the wine list, or you could ask for someone who knows the wine list well. Ask that person what they're excited about on the list, and you could narrow it down for them and say something like, you know, I think we're going to have steak tonight. We love a full-bodied red. What are you excited about on the list? And, you know, if you really want to keep the price issue out of it, and the server or the sommelier or whomever is standing beside you, you can tip the list up so that only you and she or he can see the list. And you can be pointing at the prices and say, do you have anything along this line?
We have a funny story about that. Our friend in London, he forgot his glasses. And he was entertaining this whole party of his friends, his partner's relatives. And he wanted to impress them. He pointed to the list, and he didn't have his glasses on. And he thought it was going to be a $50 bottle of wine.
It was $500. And it was pounds. He was in London. It was pounds.
It wasn't then.
Oh, my goodness.
So Charlie, yes.
Natalie mentioned her newsletter, and I would like for you to give us, please, your free newsletter and your website, Natalie, before we forget
sure.
to do that.
Great. It's just nataliemclain.com, my name, and folks, if they're interested, can sign up for the free newsletter. There's also information about Red, White, and Drunk all over on the site itself.
Okay, and it's Natalie, and it's
yes.
M-A-C... M-A-C is
yeah.
what I have. M-A-C-L-E-A-N.
That's it.
Yeah, .com.
That's
okay.
right.
Now we're going to do Peter's
okay,
question.
Charlie, have at it. What, from a restaurateur's point of view, what's the instruction to your people who are selling wine?
Well, the people who are selling wine, let me just comment first on, you know, the customer, because, you know, as a restaurateur, I'm still a customer in wine in restaurants, and I like to go to restaurants and experience things. And, you know, I always tell people, you know, from an advice point of view, that if you can go to a restaurant, if you're hosting a dinner, let's say you're the host and you're going to have business associates coming to join you or social or whatever, get there a little bit early and look at the list. You know, if you get there a little bit early and able to get the sommelier or, like, you know, like Natalie said, the person that put the list together, and kind of peruse it beforehand and get an idea of the list, and that you can usually come up with not only what the price range you want to spend in, because I think that's the most important thing, and a big misconception, because if my sommelier is in the restaurant, know what you want to spend, they'll find you the best bottle that they can think of for what you're going to dine or what you're going to eat in that price range, you know, because it's all over the place these days. I mean, it doesn't,
yeah,
you know, to drink
true.
A great bottle of wine, it doesn't have to be a $100
exactly.
bottle of wine, you know.
Now, Charlie, back to your cookbook here. Now, we've talked about the fact that it's this amazing paper, and you can briefly tell us how you found this thing, splatterproof, sauceproof, waterproof paper for this cookbook, which makes sense. And the other thing about it is that aside from its miraculous fabrication, it is beautifully organized. I mean, it's probably how you've gotten all these acolytes, is because you explain everything brilliantly and you walk people through the process of cooking
right.
fine foods. So first of all, how hard was it getting this paper?
It was difficult to find somebody that did this. And this is the first ever cookbook done in this process, this DuraBook process, because it's actual, you know, it's actual material. It's not coated paper. It's actually made of this synthetic material, and it's totally green too. It's like, you know, the idea of this, you know, recyclable again and again and again. So I think that's a great point. But the idea of this book is totally different than anything I've done before, and quite honestly, probably than most chefs do, because as chefs and professionals, we try to create cookbooks that are big, beautiful, wonderful books, which I have three of before this. But are people going to really cook for them? And that's what I asked myself with this book. I wanted to do a book that people are really going to take into the kitchen, go into battle, you know, and really cook from. Because
oh, it's great. I mean, you break it down into the perfect equipment.
The front of the book is all technique.
Yeah.
And I talk about ways to improve your kitchen life. And they're very simple, and they're very straightforward. Just like the title says, it's a practical guide, like how to build a pantry and what's important. You know, what when you're buying knives, what to look for.
Yes,
pots and pans,
great.
You know, because these are the questions that I'm asked over and over again. And they're very simple questions, but you know what? It's all the foundation of being a good home cook. And I think, you know, the response we've got to this so far and you know, what people really love about it is that I think this time I've been successful in really translating what I feel and what I, you know, what I think about cooking to the home cook.
Oh, it's the most lucid, logical presentation of technique.
Yeah, graphics of the book
and
everything
else. And the recipes
are
good too.
I think it comes through that way, and you know, I'm really proud of it in the sense that I could get to this point because, you know, as a chef, you know, you're always, you know, you're coming, you know, you're trying to document what you do in the restaurants and stuff like that. But at the end of the day, it's very difficult for people to reproduce that at home, you know?
Yeah. Now, you have a website. I might point out, by the way, that both of these books, as well as Francois Payard's book, can be ordered directly from our website. Just go to OTM Bookshelf, right?
OTM Bookshelf. You got it.
And you can order it there. But if you want people visiting your website, you better give us that too, Charlie.
Yeah, it's simply charliepalmer.com. You know,
right.
And it's a great website. We always have great recipes and, you know, dishes on the site, and they change all the time. So it's a great resource. But, you know, it has all our, you know, all the restaurants and menus in the restaurants, obviously, and everything like that. And it's a great site to go to. It's a very exciting, you know.
I just found my recipe. It's on page 92.
Okay.
Yeah, go ahead. Come on. What is it? What is it, Charlie? There's a clue.
Oh, the Guinness Braised Short Rib.
You got it. There's a guy. He even knows it. He knows it. The funny part about it is
I heard the Guinness in the voice. See there?
I graduated from the university made famous by the History Boys.
Yeah.
And the guy next to me in line when I graduated was Dermot Guinness.
Oh, yeah? Very good.
Because we were alphabetical. He's G-U-I-M-H-A-I, so we were right next to one another.
Perfect.
I remember being very impressed as parents gave my house as a graduation present. I thought that was pretty good.
But the one thing, Natalie, I should point out in this book, too, you know, I really, from a wine point of view, I wanted to really kind of make this very, once again, very accessible. And instead of suggesting certain wines or, you know, exact wines with this, each recipe has a little icon with grapes that says, for instance, like with the Guinness Braised Short Ribs, is a you know, Cabernet from the Napa Valley floor, complex, big, and bold.
This is the style of wine I think should go with this. These little icons of like white grapes, or they're really yellow grapes, and red grapes.
Because you could also drink Guinness with it too, I guess.
You could absolutely drink Guinness with it.
You could certainly do that.
As the picture insinuates. But now, you know, that's the idea too. I think people, when they're thinking about what wine to go with a certain dish, whether they're cooking a dish, whether they're eating a dish, you know, is to think like the style of wine they want to drink, or the style of wine they like. You know, that's the other thing about the wine being so subjective, that people, I really feel people should drink what they enjoy. You know,
yes, I couldn't agree more. That's,
you know,
that's right on, Charlie. Yeah,
I think you did it.
I deal with that food and wine matching too in Red, White, and Drunk All Over. We have a dinner party and we match all kinds of dishes with all kinds of wines, and it really comes down to personal taste.
Yes, mm-hmm.
Charlie, I thought your recommendation about going early was just a hugely insightful suggestion. I mean, if I'm taking friends out to a business dinner, if I'm taking a business acquaintance out to dinner, I'll try to go to the place the day before.
Sure.
Just to check it out.
Absolutely,
and
you can do that.
But it also gives you a chance to talk through the wine list. We had the pleasure of having David Lynch wait on us at Babbo when we were there. We didn't even know who he was.
Right. It was a long time ago.
we said, can you take our order? He said, well, I'm the sommelier, but I guess I can. And,
listen, we have like a minute.
We have a minute.
We have 1 minute. We're going to be
Then we should let our talkers have a listen.
Yes. Have our guest's last word, Natalie.
Oh, well, I just hope that I really enjoyed this, and I hope folks will come to my site and let me know what questions they have, because that'll be the basis for my next book.
NatalieMcLean.com. That was going to be my next question. What's next? How about you, Charlie?
Well, it depends on their questions.
Yeah. Charlie, last word.
I just have to say to people, if they're concerned about getting their cookbook messy in the kitchen, this is the answer right here. So, you know, throw it in the dishwasher when you're done. And, you know, and we hope, you know, I think that everything, like Natalie says, that food and wine are such great things that, you know, I just hope people enjoy food and wine, because that's my goal in life, is to have people do that.
Well, amen. That's wonderful. I think we're gonna be out of here. We loved having both of you on.
We're going to be out of here.
Thoroughly enjoyed it, and keep us posted what you're up to.
We're having spicy pork stew tonight in our house, and we're going to have a big red with it.
There you go.
Thank you both for joining us, listeners.
Thank you.
Same time, same place next week.
Bye-bye.